navigating our dysfunctional healthcare system.
She had a bacterial infection with Group B strep, which would have been totally susceptible to being treated with good old-fashioned penicillin. But because she didn't get the treatment for the next 5 days and she languished at home being treated for a flu that she didn't have, the infection ultimately overwhelmed her and she died.
That's patient safety lawyer and author Patrick Malone. We'll talk to him about his book, The Life You Save. It's about how to keep from being a victim of medical errors. We'll also talk with novelist Lionel Shriver about health insurance gone very, very wrong. Her new novel is So Much for That.
I'm reading this poem tonight primarily for its images, so reminiscent of the scenes in Gaza a little over a year ago, evoking slaughter of innocents.
And that's poet Martina Spada. We'll hear from him, Richard Wilbur, and other poets at a reading to benefit the children of Gaza. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Medical mistakes claim more lives each year than breast cancer, AIDS, and car crashes combined. As much as 100,000 people, with an estimated 40,000 injuries every day. Lawyer Patrick Malone says these injuries are preventable, and you can keep them from happening to you. His book, The Life You Save, proposes 9 steps to finding the best medical care and avoiding the worst. Among them are when to know when you have symptoms your doctor shouldn't ignore, and how to sort fact from hype in medical news. Patrick Malone is a patient safety advocate and medical malpractice lawyer. He's been called one of the best 500 lawyers in the U.S. He begins The Life You Save with a tragic case of a man with a mole.
This was a client of mine named Richard Semsker, who himself was a lawyer, who had a small mole on his lower back, and he really paid no attention to it. He couldn't even really see it, but he had gone to a dermatologist on several occasions to have other kind of boils drained on his back that were painful, and it turned out that his internist and his dermatologist were following this mole but not telling him anything about it as it doubled in size over a few years. And then by the time his wife finally noticed that, that little mole on your back is bigger and it's changed color, and then he went to see a doctor about it specifically, by that point it had turned into a terribly aggressive malignant melanoma, which then killed him after a very painful ordeal. And the lesson of the story was that here in this poor guy's medical records was the proof that this thing had originally been about the size of a pencil head eraser, and then it was about the size of a dime. And during all that time, although it was documented in the records, he never learned any of this. It's one of the strange features of our medical culture here in the United States, and it's not unique to the U.S. Many Western countries are like this, but doctors will write letters to each other about patients, and the patients don't get a copy of the letter. It's all about you, but somehow you're irrelevant to the communication. So the first step in my 9 steps for getting better medical care in my book is get your medical records and read them. And if you do that, you will not only prevent the occasional tragic miscommunication where everybody assumed the patient knew about this mole but somehow the patient was never told, but more importantly, you'll just learn a lot about yourself, and it will help break the ice for you to become a more proactive and involved patient, knowledgeable about your own health care.
This was a case that could have been remedied by him just having his own medical record with him. You say that preventable medical error is at epidemic levels in the U.S., that something like 40,000 people die every year. Is that right?
More than that, I'm afraid. It's more like 100,000 deaths per year. That was an estimate made 10 years ago by a group called the Institute of Medicine, which is part of the National Academies of Sciences. They issued a groundbreaking report called To Err is Human. And since then, the estimates have only gone up. There also are estimated to be about another 100,000 deaths every year from preventable hospital infections. And then on top of that are just injuries that happen to people without killing them. And those happen in the millions per year. The proof of that was kind of interesting. There's a group that does very good work in the medical industry called the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. And they set up a pilot project to reduce medical errors over the course of 2 years by adopting about 12 different things that they wanted hospitals and doctors and nurses to do. And they called it the 5 Million Lives Campaign because they figured that in 2 years they could prevent 5 million injuries. So it's just a huge, huge problem. And it has not gotten the attention it deserves in all of our debate about health care reform over the last year, which has been consumed mostly with the financial aspect of medicine, which itself is very problematic, as we all know.
And wouldn't saving on these errors also save a whole lot of money?
Yes, because when you injure somebody needlessly, you cause all kinds of repercussions, and you know the waves in the pond just keep rippling out in very tragic and terrible directions. So this guy, Mr. Semsker, lost his life. His wife lost a husband of 20 years. His teenage twin daughters lost their father. He underwent a couple $100,000 worth of chemotherapy, gamma knife, which is a very focused radiation therapy, all sorts of stuff, all of which could have easily been prevented by a simple outpatient biopsy to remove this mole on his lower back.
Right. That's a scary story.
Yeah.
You mentioned this study, To Err is Human. The doctor, I believe his name is Atul Gawande.
Yes.
Has written about what he calls the list, which is a list for doctors and emergency rooms or operating rooms to check off, you know, basically for medical providers to check off to make sure that they're not making errors. You have a list or lists that you suggest for patients.
Yes, I have various checklists for patients to follow, and one of them is directly based on work by not just Dr. Gawande, who's a brilliant young surgeon in Boston, but there's an anesthesiologist at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore named Peter Pronovost, and he invented the concept of a simple checklist to prevent a particularly nasty kind of hospital infection, which is infection in a central line that is installed in a large blood vessel in people in intensive care units. And he discovered that if you take certain simple steps and you do them each and every time, and these are basic things like before you insert the central line into the patient's body, you have to totally scrub their skin with a certain kind of soap. You have to totally drape their body as if you're doing it for an operation. And then there are various other steps. And the interesting thing he found was that when they empowered nurses to call a halt to the whole proceedings because things were being done too hastily and all the steps weren't being followed, and a nurse could say to a doctor, no, I'm sorry, we've got to go back and redo this and take it a little more slowly, then that was what really made the key difference in bringing nurses full-fledged into the medical team. There's another kind of checklist that they do in operating rooms to make sure that they're operating on the right patient, that they're doing the right procedure on that patient, that they're totally prepared, like with, you know, extra units of blood if they need it, if they need patients' x-rays, make sure that's all on hand. All of those are in another checklist. But the most fascinating thing about a big article that came out about implementation of this checklist, and this is part of the World Health Organization, which is a branch of the United Nations, when they started doing this checklist all around the world, they've been doing it in operating rooms, they discovered that the most effective thing that they did is to just have everybody in the operating room introduce themselves by name so that everybody knew who the other person was. And before that, in some kind of imperious operating rooms, the surgeon is barking orders and he says, "Nurse, anesthesia," and he's addressing human beings, but he's just putting a label on them. And they discovered that people, this is a kind of, you know, old-fashioned things that we shouldn't have to relearn this, but we do. And they discovered that when you treat professionals as total human beings that are totally members of the team and that they have a name, each of them, the team works much more effectively together.
So just a simple human communication.
Yes.
Is what improves patient care.
Yes. And the patient's role in all of that is to just become, to stop being a mute member of the healthcare team. It's your body, it's your health, and you need to speak up and make sure you understand what's going on and make sure you have the right people that you're comfortable with working on you. Don't be passive, be active. Ask a lot of questions. So I have different lists for different kinds of things. For example, if you're facing very serious surgery, there's a list of things that I want you to go through to help you find the very best surgeon for your case. A lot of people kind of passively fall into just letting the first surgeon they come across operate on them, and that can be a huge mistake because you can wind up with somebody who's done this surgery maybe two or three times in their life, or you could easily find yourself with a few more questions dealing with somebody who does it two or three times every week. And you know that practice makes perfect, and you're going to get better outcomes from dealing with someone who really devotes their life to the kind of surgery that you may need to have.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with personal injury lawyer and patient advocate Patrick Malone about how to keep from being a victim of medical errors. Now, you talk also not just about surgeons, but, you know, let's take primary care physicians. And I have to say that, you know, here in Massachusetts, as well as I think in many other places in the country, it's hard to find any primary care physician, much less a good one.
Yeah, that is a real dilemma, and Congress is trying to rejigger the healthcare budget to put more money into primary care residencies. If people can afford it, I definitely recommend this thing called concierge medicine, where you pay a flat fee to a doctor. It's usually on the order of $2,000 or $3,000 a year if you can afford it, and then you get unlimited access to that doctor, email access, telephone at night. That gives very high quality care for people, if it's the right person, of course.
And I'm speaking with Patrick Malone about his book, The Life You Save, 9 Steps to Finding the Best Medical Care and Avoiding the Worst. What are some things you want to look at in a primary care physician?
There are several things. The number one thing, of course, is credentials. If the person is not well trained and they don't have the right credentials, everything else is for naught. So I suggest to people that they check the websites of the credentialing boards. You should find that your doctor is board certified in either internal medicine or family practice, or if you're looking for a child, pediatrics. And it's funny because many, many people are not board certified who purport to be general care doctors. The next thing I think that's important is that the doctor have listening skills. You want to go to somebody who, even if they're a little bit rushed, it looks like they're taking you seriously and that they hear what you're telling them. So that's very important. And empathy is also very important, because if you go to somebody and you feel frustrated with them and whatnot, you may take the advice that they give you on a piece of paper, and it kind of goes in one ear and out the other. So I think it's very important that people get somebody as a primary care doctor that they can really be in a teamwork effort with. And that's not easy, but I think it's important.
Talking about a primary care physician again, you have another tragic case of a woman who did a list. She even had an idea of what might be wrong with her, but the doctor just kind of went to the most obvious diagnosis, and she died. Tell us her story.
Yes, that was a lovely client of mine. I never met her, but I saw many photos of and videos of her, a woman in her mid-40s, highly intelligent. She had a master's degree in healthcare administration here in Washington, D.C., and she went to a doctor with a sudden, sharp lower back pain that had come about without any, you know, bending or twisting or anything, and she thought it was very puzzling. And then she started getting a low-grade fever, and he said, "Oh, you've got the flu." And she said, "Well, I also have this vaginal discharge," which I thought was yeast infection, but it didn't. The over-the-counter treatment didn't work for that. And he said, "Oh, that's what it is. That's totally separate. Don't worry about it." He did not take a critical step, which was to culture the discharge, which would have shown him that what she actually had was not two separate things going on, the flu on the one hand and a discharge on the other hand, but she had a bacterial infection with group B strep, which would have been totally susceptible to being treated with good old-fashioned penicillin, but because she didn't get the treatment for the next 5 days and she languished at home being treated for a flu that she didn't have, the infection ultimately overwhelmed her, and she died. And again, left a husband and two small children. So the very tragic thing in her story, among others, was that she had followed part of the advice I give for organizing yourself to go into a primary care doctor, which is I tell people, make a list of everything you think is wrong with you and of the symptoms and stuff like that. Write it down on a piece of paper, take it into the doctor, and use it not only as your kind of cheat sheet to guide what you're saying to the doctor, but actually give a copy to the doctor so that the doctor can have it in their files. And when you hand over this piece of paper to the doctor, suddenly they have to focus more clearly on what you're saying, and it's less easy for them to put you into a box of a diagnosis that they may be rushing towards when you have symptoms that don't fit in that box. So I tell people, make a list, leave a list with the doctor, and then on your way out the door, take a list home with you of the written steps that the doctor and you have decided are going to be the way you attack this particular problem you have. So this is all intended to break through the miscommunications that happen so often in medical care, which is delivered on such a rushed basis that we don't really understand what it is we're getting into.
You also talk about medical testing, both under-testing and over-testing. And recently there was, there was a kind of a brouhaha last year about mammogram testing. There was a study that came out that said that it really wasn't worth the false positives that people were getting and that there should be less of it and it should start later. I'd like to get your take on that issue and also have you explain something about the numbers, how one actually looks at numbers to evaluate one's own risk and why one should or should not get tested.
Yeah, I have a whole chapter on this, and it's a fascinating subject because so many of us, me included, are numerically challenged. And, you know, we can't do much more than basic arithmetic. But there's a technique I learned from another author of a very good book on kind of statistics for ordinary people, and that is to count the numbers of people who are involved in whatever the study is, and that helps you get around a lot of the vagueness in medical statistics so that you really understand what's going on. With mammograms, for example, it turns out that when they talk about saving, that mammograms, for example, women in their 40s will have reduced risk of death by 25% if they regularly get mammograms. Well, that is based on a Swedish study which came out about 10, 15 years ago, and it found that, in fact, if you tested 1,000 women who had no symptoms at all, but you gave them a mammogram each and every year for 10 years, so you had a total of 10,000 mammograms in that group of 1,000 women, the rate of breast cancer in those women, of incurable breast cancer, would go down from about 4 in 1,000 to 3 in 1,000. And 4 to 3 is a 25% reduction. But that's the slipperiness of the numbers. When we hear 25%, we think, gee, that's me. That's a 1 in 4 chance that I'll live when I'll be killed otherwise. What it really means, when you understand the numbers, is that for 1,000 people being treated with regular mammogram screening in their 40s, only one of them is going to benefit from that. Now, I'm not saying nobody should get them. It's a very personal choice. But I think it's important for people to understand the numbers behind statistics, medical statistics that get bandied about, so that you know if you really need a treatment or not, or you feel comfortable with it. The same is true for all kinds of things. I've got another example in the book where we talk about cholesterol-lowering drugs. And in certain groups of men who have an elevated, what they call C-reactive protein, but they don't have high cholesterol per se, those men, supposedly according to one study, can benefit dramatically, like a 50% reduction in heart attack rates by taking the cholesterol-lowering drugs like Lipitor. Well, when you look at the numbers closely, it's nowhere near that because it's a kind of a numbers shell game that's going on, and the true reality is that very few people would be helped from getting the drug. So it's useful to kind of try to understand some of these studies and read them carefully and just count the overall number of people involved in a study, and that will help you understand the true risks and benefits of you undergoing this particular test or drug or whatever.
The book is The Life You Save, and we're talking with author Patrick Malone. The example that you are giving here, which is the one about using statins for people who have normal blood pressure.
Normal cholesterol.
Normal cholesterol. It came out last year, and it seemed to me that it was really touted by the press as this great breakthrough, this idea that you could decrease eventual cardiovascular problems by something like 50%. How did you, as a former journalist, how do you think that the journalists got this so wrong? I mean, after all, they should be trained in this just like you were.
Well, they went with the PowerPoint headlines and didn't get behind it to the real numbers. For example, in this particular study, it turned out that you had two groups of people. You had the people taking the dummy pill, the placebo, and then you had the people taking the real statin pill, and they measured the number of heart attacks that those men had. And these are men in their 60s, so they're, at fairly high risk for a heart attack anyway. So it turned out that in the placebo group, 18 of 1,000 people had a heart attack. In the statin group, 9 in 1,000 had a heart attack. So that's where they came up with the headline that said 50% reduction in heart attacks. But that's only if you're guaranteed to have a heart attack in the first place, like if you were in the 18. Nobody knows they're in the 18. They're in the group of 1,000 people. And your real risk of having a heart attack is only reduced by about 1% if you count the numbers, because you go from being in a group where you had an 18 in 1,000 chance of having a heart attack to a 9 in 1,000 chance of having a heart attack. That 9 in 1,000 is about the same as 1 in 100. So it's a 1% savings, not a 50% savings. So there's another number that you can use and look for in the studies, which is what they call the number needed to treat, the total number of patients that are needed to be treated in order for there to be a benefit from whatever the intervention is. In mammograms, for example, in younger women, you have to treat thousands of women for there to be one life saved. In the statin drugs, for people who do not have elevated cholesterol, but they do have a elevated C-reactive protein, those people, 120 patients need to be treated with statins over a two-year period for one of those 120 to benefit. Now, some people might think, if I have a 1 in 120 chances of getting better by taking this drug every day for the rest of my life, that's good enough for me. I want to do everything I can to lower my risk. Other people will think, well, you know, there are side effects from every drug, and it's a lot of hassle, and I'm not going to bother. So it's a personal choice, but it needs to be an informed choice.
Right. Another place where information is really important is information that not only you may have, but that somebody that you bring with you to the hospital might have. You talk a lot about patient advocates and their role. And I have to say, I understand this because my mother has been in and out of the hospital, and it seemed like when I was there to advocate for her and make sure that the nurses came and got her what she needed and that they knew what she was wanting, she got much better care, and the days or the times that I wasn't there, she got ignored.
And that is absolutely 100% true, practically. No matter how good the hospital is, nurses are rushed. The squeaking wheel gets the grease. You need to be there for your elderly parent, your child, whoever it may be. Everybody needs to have an advocate for them in the hospital, because when we're hospitalized, you know, we're flat on our backs. We're not able to ask the questions for ourselves. We need somebody with us. And so I've got a list of a few things that I think just regular lay people can do to advocate in the hospital to prevent some very, very major types of injuries that happen in the hospital. One being getting the wrong medicine, another being falling out of bed and suffering a hip fracture or something serious like that. That is the death knell for so many, many elderly people, getting a hip fracture, and it doesn't have to happen. Blood clots are another thing that happen in hospitals that the layperson advocate can help prevent. And then another area is infections, helping to enforce the rule that every time the nurse or the doctor comes into the room, they should wash their hands before touching the patient. It's better that that comes from the person sitting there rather than, you know, being the advocate rather than the patient themselves.
Well, it is a wonderful book, Patrick Malone, The Life You Save, 9 Steps to Finding the Best Medical Care. And I regret that we didn't have time to go through all the 9. It's just really packed with excellent information and resources. So thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. And I could mention the book website if people want to check it out. They can see the 9 steps on there and get more information about the book. The website is lifeyousave.com.
And we will be linking to that from our website, writersvoice.net. Thanks again.
Very good.
Patrick Malone. You can read the first chapter of The Life You Save at writersvoice.net. Next up, Lionel Shriver's new novel, So Much for That. And later, poets reading at a benefit for the children of Gaza.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Health insurance reform is now the law of the land, even though most of its benefits won't kick in for another 4 years. The reform has come under attack from both the right and the left. Right-wingers have gone into paroxysms of paranoia, claiming it will bring communism to America. The bill has also been criticized by progressives for not going far enough and for being a boondoggle for the health insurance companies. American novelist Lionel Shriver lives in England, where they have socialized medicine that covers everybody at a fraction of the cost of the U.S. healthcare system. Her new book takes on the predatory practices of American health insurance companies. The L.A. Times called it a ferocious black comedy about the horrors of the American healthcare system. Shriver decided to write the novel when she learned that the leading cause of bankruptcy in the U.S. is medical bills, and a majority of those going broke have health insurance.
That just floored me. It left me thinking, well, then what is health insurance for? I think this is a good topic for a novel, even if it seems unlikely. You know, the articles we read about healthcare and healthcare reform, they tend to be very dry. But behind the headlines are many, many individual families who are losing their life savings and at the same time having to deal with one of the hardest things there is to deal with, and that is catastrophic illness and sometimes of a terminal kind. So I thought that fiction can illustrate the emotional reality behind all of these tedious stories.
You have your protagonist, Shepard Nacker, who starts out with close to $1 million that he's been saving all his life. Well, he's been saving up for his dream, and he finds himself just on the verge of making it a reality when he gets some very bad news.
Yes, Shep has saved up his whole life for what he calls the afterlife. And that is, he noticed when he was on a trip to Africa with his father as a teenager that a dollar goes so much farther when you're in the third world. And he reasoned that it would be possible to save your pennies in with a normal income. And then depart for the third world, and you know, if you saved enough, you would be able to live on it for the rest of your life. As the book begins, he and his wife have been taking regular, what they call, research trips to different countries, deciding where they might depart to when they've got enough money. And little by little, he's noticed that his wife, Glynis, is just not serious about this project. She always comes up with reasons why now is not the time to go, even when they have the money to cut out. So he says, you know, look, this is really a matter of loyalty to my very self. This is what I've planned my whole life, and I bought the plane tickets, and I would love it if you came with me, but if you won't, I'm still going to go. And she seems strangely unaffected by this announcement of his, because she has an announcement of her own, and that is that she's just been diagnosed with cancer. And my main character, Shep, is a good man. Actually, he's one of the most virtuous characters I've ever crafted. And this is the one thing that would keep him from catching that airplane. He's not going to desert his wife in her time of need. He wouldn't do that to her emotionally. And furthermore, she desperately needs his health insurance, so he can't quit working.
She needs his health insurance, but it's not exactly one of those Cadillac plans.
No. It's what I call the health insurance company from hell. I gave this company every underhanded practice out there.
And what are those practices?
Oh, what really devastates his savings is this out-of-network nonsense. The two doctors that they go to who are experts in Glynis's cancer, which is mesothelioma, a surgeon and an internist, are determined to be out of network by their provider, and that means that they get stuck with 40% of the bill. And when you're dealing with 40% of treatments that cost a couple of million dollars, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, it certainly is. And you watch his savings dwindle from close to a million to nothing, almost to the end of the book. Mesothelioma, that's a very rare kind of cancer. In fact, its only known cause is exposure to asbestos.
That's correct.
Why did you pick mesothelioma?
Well, for one thing, I like the complication of asbestos in the plot. I like the fact that Glynis first blames her husband for probably exposing her to asbestos because he runs a handyman company and he might have worked with asbestos-laced materials. So I like that emotional complexity. But the other reason I chose it was just personal. And I had a very close friend of mine, someone I've known for 25 years, die of mesothelioma in late 2006. And that was partly the inspiration for this novel. I went through with her what it was like to go through those grueling treatments, this absolutely ghastly chemotherapy. And then, of course, she died anyway.
Yeah, it's almost invariably, it is invariably fatal, I believe.
It's one of the deadliest cancers out there, and by the time it's diagnosed, it's almost always too late. And that doesn't keep them from putting you through this punishing regimen of poison. So what little life remains to you is usually pretty miserable.
Now, Glynis, his wife, is a pretty prickly person and quite bitter, of course. She in fact, is sorry that her disease is not contagious. That kind of gives you an idea. You must have had an awful lot of fun writing her.
I had a ball writing Glynis. You know, Glynis doesn't play the role that we expect of terminally ill people. Generally, we want them to be gracious and philosophical and even ideally tell us, you know, what it's like to be facing the end of life and therefore, you know, what is the meaning of life? What have you learned from your experience? And Glynis just will not play along with this notion of what it's like to be sick. And getting a terminal illness at the age of 50, which these days is very young, makes her furious, absolutely furious. And she makes life extremely difficult for people in her surround.
Yeah, she does. And Shep is such a good man. I wonder, is he perhaps too good?
Well, there is a suggestion in the novel that he is too good. That is, there's a certain kind of virtue that people take advantage of. Unfortunately, when you're one of those responsible people, other people are more than happy to heap their problems on you.
And his marriage goes through an evolution. I mean, as you pointed out before, his wife, you know, you get the idea that she looked, for a long time, she'd been looking upon his afterlife project with a fairly jaundiced eye. Their communication had really pretty much broken down for a long time. But this illness, which robs him of his dream, brings them together.
Yes, it does. I mean, I'm interested in the way that catastrophic illness has a dual function in the marriage. That is, it can be alienating because one of you is going through something so drastically different than the other. You're living in very different universes. But at the same time, it's also an opportunity to come together and to realize how precious your time is left. You know, and their marriage goes through any number of transitions through the book. But in the end, Glynis's illness is an opportunity for them to become more intimate and to finally be loving and expressive and grateful in a way that they are not at the beginning of the book.
Now, they have a couple who are friends. Shep has a best friend in that couple. His name is Jackson, and he knows a whole lot about the medical system also. In fact, I think he's the one who first tells Shep, or maybe it was his wife, that Shep's plan ain't that great, because his own daughter has a rare genetic disease. And is this a real disease?
Oh, yes.
Tell us what it is and what some of the symptoms are.
It's called familial dysautonomia, or FD for short. And it's an exclusively Jewish genetic disease. And very, very rare. Only about 350 people in the world have it. It used to be utterly fatal. And these kids didn't live past about 5 years old. Nowadays, FD kids are living into their 20s and sometimes 30s. But it's a weird disease. It's a dysfunction of the autonomic system, meaning everything that is automatic in your and my bodies, they have to think about, or they have to regulate with drugs. Things like blood pressure, body temperature. They have to learn to swallow, which comes naturally to everybody else. But no, they have to have lessons in how to eat. I had wanted to find a disease that other writers hadn't taken on, so that, you know, it would be interesting. And also I wanted a condition that was going to be expensive and very demanding of the parents.
And the daughter is no shrinking violet.
Oh, no. Oh, Flicka, my FD kid, who's 16 when the novel starts. He's a lot like Glynis. In fact, they find common cause in their dyspepsia. Flicka refuses to play the sunny, disabled kid who, you know, is just grateful for every new day. She talks back. She hates her condition. She also doesn't like the way that her genetic disease becomes for other people her whole personality. She wants to be recognized for the person she is. And she goes around, you know, essentially threatening to commit suicide all the time. She's constantly telling her parents that she wishes she were dead.
And she has a marvelous personality as well. I mean, a lusty soul.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, she's got a lot of spark, a lot of fight, and she's very smart. I mean, for example, she says, look, I'm probably going to be dying by my early 20s, so why do I have to get an education, right? Why am I going to school? What's this for? Why do I need to know about the Civil War? And she's got a point.
Now, her father is also, he's a character. He's a, I guess you'd call him a curmudgeon, a ranter. Well, not a curmudgeon towards his family, but towards towards politics. He's one of those guys, you can just imagine him when the news comes on.
He would never shut up. Don't you hate those people?
Yeah, but he's great. So tell us about him.
Jackson is a working-class autodidact. That is, he's only got a high school education, and he didn't pay much attention even in high school. But he's taught himself everything he knows. He's one of those Internet junkies, so that you know, he's constantly getting new factoids from the Internet, and which he has to tell everyone else about. But he's also deeply insecure. He's a smart man, but having not got a formal education, he doubts himself a little bit. And that ends up explaining why he... Well, we won't go into the details, but...
No.
there is a subplot in this book, Plastic Surgery Goes Wrong. And it's certainly meant to be one of the... Well, it's grisly, but it's certainly one of the more entertaining subplots in the book.
It's certainly dramatic, I have to say. The ending is a kind of real contrast to the rest of the book. There's a real sweetness that pervades it.
Yeah, it's almost got a fairy tale ending. I don't think that we ruin things for your listeners who want to read the book to give away that they can at least look forward to a happy ending. And I thought this book absolutely required that. It's just such a relief when you've gone through this Jobian experience with my friend Shep, so much going wrong. I just felt I owed it to him to give him something nice in the book.
And not to speak of the Jobian experience of the other family in the book as well. And they all partake in the happy ending.
Yes.
I think you're right. It really did need it, and it made it very satisfying.
Yeah. That was my intention, that I didn't want to just leave you with, you know, anger and despair. I think this book as you said, you know, it finally lands in a sweet place. And certainly for me as the writer, that was an enormous relief. And I'm hoping that it delivers the same experience to the reader.
Well, Lionel Shriver, your book is So Much for That. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
I really enjoy talking to you.
In addition to her novel, So Much for That, Lionel Shriver is the author of We Need to Talk About Kevin, for which he won the 2005 Orange Prize. Shriver's written 8 other novels and writes a column for The Guardian. April is Poetry Month. On March 25th, 11 poets got the jump on Poetry Month, coming together for a serious purpose: a benefit reading for the children of Gaza, who are living in what some describe as the biggest prison in the world. 80% of families in Gaza live in poverty, unable to work or get the necessities of life because of the Israeli blockade. Malnutrition is rampant, especially among children. The event was called Moving Toward Home, A Reading for Gaza. We'll play excerpts from the event over the course of this and coming months, but we'll start out today with readings by 4 of the poets who were there: Richard Wilbur, Doug Anderson, Martina Spada, and Betsy Reina. First, Richard Wilbur sets the tone with one of his most famous poems, Advice to a Prophet.
The children of Gaza are surrounded on every side by nuclear threats. And so that made me think of this poem that I tried to write from Hiroshima on until I finally got it down in 1956, I think, with the help of the chairman of the AEC and of Bertrand Russell, who had both written on the subject of the likely effect of radiation on plant and animal life. That directed me to a way of imagining, a way of helping other people imagine what it might be. The poet in this poem is presuming to advise the prophet who is coming to town how he ought to prophesy. It's called Advice to a Prophet. When you come, as you soon must, to the streets of our city, mad-eyed from stating the obvious, not proclaiming our fall, but begging us in God's name to have self-pity. Spare us all word of the weapons, their force and range, the long numbers that rocket the mind. Our slow, unreckoning hearts will be left behind, unable to fear what is too strange. Nor shall you scare us with talk of the death of the race. How should we dream of this place without us? The sun, mere fire, the leaves untroubled about us, a stone look on the stone's face. Speak of the world's own change. Though we cannot conceive of an undreamt thing, we know to our cost how the dreamt cloud crumbles, the vines are blackened by frost, how the view alters. We could believe, if you told us so, that the white-tailed deer will slip into perfect shade, grown perfectly shy, the lark avoid the reaches of our eye, the jackpine lose its knuckled grip on the cold ledge, and every torrent burn as Xanthus once, its gliding trout stunned in a twinkling. What should we be without the dolphin's ark, the dove's return, these things in which we have seen ourselves and spoken? Ask us, prophet, how we shall call our natures forth, when that live tongue is all dispelled, that glass obscured or broken, in which we have said the rose of our love and the clean horse of our courage, in which beheld the singing locust of the soul unshelled, and all we mean or wish to mean. Ask us, whether with the worldless rose our hearts shall fail us. Come demanding whether there shall be lofty or long standing when the bronze annals of the oak tree close.
Richard Wilbur. Poet Doug Anderson knows war with the intimacy of a soldier. He fought in Vietnam, and much of his work concerns the horrors and unlikely friendships of that time. But here he reads a poem to another friend, Martina Spada.
Letter to Martina Spada. In Central America, magic realism is a way of life. It's not a literary style. It just happens all around you. I went down there for a poetry convention, and Sonsonate, which is a little town near the Izalco volcano. We were led up on the stage to read our poems, for which there were Spanish translations, at least in my case, and little old ladies in black were throwing rose petals on us. I have never had rose petals thrown on me at a poetry reading. And each poet, the mayor, by the way, introduced us, and each poet was announced by a fireworks rocket. Now, magical realism, what can I say? Great audience, by the way. Letter to Martina Spada. Dear Martine, in Izalco, while Christ waits for Easter in his glass tomb in the cathedral, a single long note is blown on a trumpet in El Parque Central. Los perros flacos forage at the feet of la gente. Los poetas mount the stage in a shower of rose petals thrown by old ladies. The mayor opens his arms wide. In the audience are campesinos, hijitos, shopkeepers, viejos, the town trauma surgeon, and a generous contingent of la policía con pistolas, escopetas y M-16s. Solamente el volcán duerme esta noche. Los perros flacos jump into the big blue garbage cans. Martín, you will certainly believe this. Each poeta is introduced with a fireworks rocket. Los perros flacos jump out of the big blue garbage cans. Poetas de Argentina, Taiwan, Guatemala, España, Peru, Nicaragua, France, Costa Rica, Brazil, Venezuela, Chile, and los Estados Unidos open their mouths. Out come pájaros, serpientes y duendes, hombres, mujeres y alquimistas with flasks of ether. Out come revolutionaries in diapers, ambassadors in limousines of obsidian, the Virgin in a Madonna t-shirt, y los indios with flutes made of thigh bones and bombs made of skulls. Out come the dead dictators chained together by ectoplasm-swinging censors that emit the stink of money, priests with rifles, nuns with giant beasts whose names are forgotten, hidden in the musk of their habits. Out come conquistadores on roller skates, moros in black on black motorcycles, Mad Max with tattoos de los mares salvatrucci. When los poetas have finished, there are more fireworks. They are swarmed by hijitos, viejos, y otros wanting autographs. Their hands are as soft as their hearts. Death does not hide here, but lives among them, dressed in white lace with earrings rattling on her skull. Life does not hide here, but steps through irony as if it were a vanishing fog.
Poet Doug Anderson. Let's now listen to Martina Spada read a poem by William Blake.
So trying to find something to read for tonight, I came across a poem by William Blake. Got a strange title. A prologue intended for a dramatic piece of King Edward IV. It's published in 1783. So forget the title. This is an anti-war poem in prophetic voice, written more than 225 years ago, and yet speaking to us with great urgency and great immediacy. I'm reading this poem tonight primarily for its images. So reminiscent of the scenes in Gaza a little over a year ago, evoking slaughter of innocents, even evoking bombardment from the sky. But I'm also reading this poem tonight for Blake's conclusions. Blake reminds us in this short poem that a ruling elite causes and profits from wars and occupations, inciting the rest of us to act against our own interests, even in the name of God, in the Middle East and here at home, centuries ago and in the present day. And so the poet speaks of judgment and challenges the future reader. And Blake says, "Oh, for a voice like thunder, and a tongue to drown the throat of war. When the senses are shaken and the soul is driven to madness, who can stand? When the souls of the oppressed fight in the troubled air that rages, who can stand? When the whirlwind of fury comes from the throne of God, when the frowns of his countenance drive the nations together, who can stand? When sin claps his broad wings over the battle and sails rejoicing in the flood of death, when souls are torn to everlasting fire and fiends of hell rejoice upon the slain, oh, who can stand? Oh, who hath caused this? Oh, who can answer at the throne of God? The kings and nobles of the land have done it. Hear it not, heaven. Thy ministers have done it."
When we revisit this poetry event in subsequent episodes of Writer's Voice, we'll play Martina Spada reading some of his own wonderful poetry at the event. But in the short time we have left, let's hear a poem by Betsy Reyna. As she tells us, she's no stranger to the dislocations of political violence. Reyna reads her poem, Uncertainty.
"I was born in Cuba and raised in Panama. When I left Cuba, there was a dictatorship. The Batista dictatorship. 2 months after I came to study at Mount Holyoke College, the Torrijos dictatorship took over Panama. So it was like, I felt like dictatorships were following my family. And this is a poem I wrote for my father that I think it's very applicable to the people of Gaza, and it's called Uncertainty. Uncertainty can have your name or your face, and catch up with you some afternoon when the snail that we observed in silence has had the good luck to die. Can have red wine and official sanction, and what's called repression, inflation, or coup d'etat, have military uniforms or fixed elections, while you try to control the car passing other cars on a curve, and think about the money you don't have for the rent and how to get it. Finally, uncertainty is to remind yourself each day that you spin alone with the sun and you don't have any answers."
Poet Betsy Reyna. We heard from her, Martina Spada, Doug Anderson, and Richard Wilbur. They read together with 7 other poets at a benefit reading for the Middle East Children's Alliance. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to that organization and for more information about the event, Moving Toward Home, a Reading for Gaza. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.